Okay, welcome to session number 361, Sunstone 2010, Ogden, Saturday, August 6th. The title of this session is Very Careless in His Utterances, Editing, Correcting, and Censoring Conference Addresses. The presenter is Joe Giesner, and the respondent is Levina. Be sure to silence all cell phones or other noisemakers. I'll use the method that Will Bagley used a couple years ago when cell phones went off, when he said, "Shut that damn cell phone off!" And they did. Yeah. Our presenter, Joe Giesner, is a humble fellow and submitted a short bio as follows. Joe Giesner and his wife provide residential care services for the developmentally disabled. As a teenager, Joe was able to visit with Leonard Arrington, the king of Mormon history, in 1977. We're figuring out how old he is now. In the church historian's office. This experience set Joe on a path of wanting to experience Mormon history. Since that time, Joe has become an avid reader and collector of Mormon books. Joe's main interest is his family, but he also enjoys traveling, scuba diving, and being in the great outdoors. I had only vaguely known Joe before this weekend, but we met the first night here on Wednesday night, had some really good conversations, and he's just a terrific guy. So I highly recommend your attention at his presentation. And our respondent is Levina. And as in our popular culture, we have people who are so well known that they only have one name. All you have to say is Cher, or Madonna, or Bono, or there's others. And everyone understands who you're talking about. In Mormon studies, we have Levina. It seems like she has edited about everything significant in Mormon history for a long time. And I know that whenever she's edited something to mine, it's greatly improved. My book, Homosexual Saints, would not be nearly the book it is without her great editorial hand. And the many times she told me to write and rewrite and rewrite. It is far better book, like I said, because Levina's editorial hand was on it. On a more personal level, Levina is probably my dearest friend in the LDS Church. And I consider her a real Mormon, no matter what document might be filed in that tall building downtown Salt Lake City, dated September 1993. When I went through a divorce in 1986, Levina's support was extremely meaningful to me. She showed her love in so many ways. One way was, she was always trying to fix me up with dates from various women, and I really appreciate it. Some people don't, but I did. But the only problem was they tended to be about 500 or 1,000 miles away, and so it's a little hard to forget that. And also, they tended to be about 20 years younger than me. Now, that was no doubt because I look so much younger than I am.
Or older.
Oh, yeah, I looked older than I really am.
That's no, it. Or older women.
Oh, yeah.
Too old for you, right?
Okay. Until this year, I've stayed at Levina's and Paul's house during Sunstone virtually every year for the last 15 or 20 years. So.
You still have our house.
I've still got the house key, but we'll use it next year to go back to Salt Lake City. I'm not going to mention the many editorial responsibilities she's been involved with. It's a very long list. But Levina, I'm just going to mention a few things. Levina and Janice Allred produced 3 volumes of the case reports of the Mormon Alliance. She is the past president of the Association of Mormon Letters. She produced Lucy's book, a critical edition of Lucy Mack Smith's family memoir, and that was a wonderful book. I reviewed it, I think, or at least was on a panel regarding it, and is currently researching Lucy's life, a biography of Lucy Mack Smith. She's an honorary life member of the Association of Mormon Letters and the Mormon History Association. So finally, I'm going to give a charge to both of these speakers here today. It comes from Joseph Smith III's charge that he gave to pastors and other priesthood who are going to be occupying the pulpit. be as eloquent as Paul, be as persuasive as Peter, as patient as Job, as wise as Solomon, as meek as Samuel, as strong as Samson, as loving as John, and as faithful as Daniel. I hope this will be helpful, but don't feel any pressure.
Tough act to follow. At the Sunday morning session of the October 3rd, 2010 General Conference, President Boyd K. Packer gave a talk titled, Cleansing the Inner Vessel. A couple of sentences and a number of words were changed from the presented talk to the published talk on the internet at LDS.org. Almost instantly, these amendments were being analyzed in the media and on the internet. Some sources suggested these types of edits are common for General Conference talks. Others argued that this was rare or uncommon, possibly a monumental moment in Mormon history. I found one comment particularly insightful. A friend who recently worked with the church's website confirmed to me privately that all of the talks, not just some, were prepared in advance, run through correlation in the First Presidency's office, and ultimately offered word by word during delivery. My friend said that nothing goes up on the website until all changes, even minuscule ones like adding my dear brothers and sisters, are at the beginning are reconciled. On October 8, Scott Trotter, LDS Church spokesman, released the following statement regarding the edits made in Elder Packer's talk. The Monday following every general conference, each speaker has the opportunity to make any edits necessary to clarify differences between what was written and what was delivered, or to clarify the speaker's intent. President Packer has simply clarified his intent. On October 27th, Second Counselor in the First Presidency, Dieter F. Uchtdorf, spoke at a regional conference in Utah saying, God loves all of his children and expects everyone to do the same. There was speculation that his comments were meant to emphasize the changes made in Elder Packer's talk. Since then, I began to wonder how often conference addresses have been edited, challenged, or possibly censored. I was familiar with Gary Bejerra's work, which documented Brigham Young's censoring and correcting of Orson Pratt's conference addresses. With this paper, I would like to focus on addresses that were given after the church began publishing the conference reports, beginning with the October 1897 conference. I found a total of 11 that were either significantly edited before publication or were excised from the official published conference report. I should point out that conference reports were discontinued by the church in 2009, almost certainly because the church's website, making them quickly accessible, along with the availability of the ensign. Only 1 year after the first report, the conference report for the October 1898 General Conference was missing two addresses. One address was given by 40-year-old Apostle John W. Taylor, a son of President John Taylor, and the other address was given by President George Q. Cannon, first counselor to President Lorenzo Snow. The Taylor address is titled Morality and Chastity, and Cannon's is titled Response to Elder Taylor, which was delivered at the Friday session, October 7, 1898. Both discourses were deleted from the official record of conference and are not found in the conference report of that year. Both addresses can be found in the fifth volume of Brian Stye's Collective Discourses. Taylor began his talk benignly enough when he startled the audience, but then he startled the audience by reporting conversations with an unnamed man who accused members of the Camas Utah Ward of having a conspicuous number of already pregnant brides at the time of marriage, and also that members of the Mormon Tabernacle Choir were engaging in immoral practices. Yeah. It gets better. Taylor told his conference attendees that, I was informed that 8 out of every 10 of the marriages that have been of such character that the wives have had children before they were married. While conversing with this gentleman, another man came up, whose word I could not doubt, and said, I was informed by a lady in Salt Lake who keeps a mourning house that after the close of practice by the Tabernacle Choir, several members come to her rooming house for immoral purposes. After Taylor was finished, George Q. Cannon immediately stepped to the podium, chastised Taylor for his remarks, and at the same time tried to smooth the accused member's hurt feelings by telling the audience, "We have regretted, I speak for the First Presidency, that there should be any mention of any particular place as being worse in this respect than others, for we have no reason to believe that this is the case." Cannon continued with this line of reasoning and also said that if there was a problem, it should have been handled in private, not in a public setting. Brigham Young Jr. recorded in his diary that during the session, President Joseph F. Smith made some wise remarks, followed by Brother John Taylor, who made some very unwise remarks. President Cannon stated, "Brother Taylor was wrong, had no right to speak on hearsay accusing innocent persons of immoral practices, laid some of it to his zeal. President George Q. Cannon was very kind to John and allayed feelings which was aroused against John W. Taylor." As can be expected, people in the audience, the choir, and those from Camas were very upset. When the voting of the general authorities was done the Sunday after his talk, all were unanimous, but in the case of John W. Taylor, some few voted against him for remarks made on Friday about Camas Ward and the Salt Lake Tabernacle Choir. Following the Sunday Solemn Assembly, Elder Taylor met with the choir and arranged his troubles with them. At the October 1909 conference, there was quite a stir. On Wednesday, October 6, 1909, B.H. Roberts spoke for 50 to 60 minutes, and for the most part devoted to a criticism of the present church administration, according to George F. Richards. As Reed Smoot puts it, Roberts occupied most of the time. Smoot also said Roberts spoke of the faults and shortcomings of the prophet Joseph and others and the necessity of keeping sacred an agreement. His whole remarks had behind them a spirit of fault-finding, but many of the things he said, and in and of themselves, were fine. People wondered what he was driving at. Apostle John Henry Smith commented that Brigham H. Roberts made the longest talk of conference, showing the mistakes of the saints during all time. The controversy with the talk started because of a letter Roberts had written on March 30, 1908, to Richard R. Lyman, a fellow Democrat, university professor, and future apostle, that appeared in the daily papers in early June 1908. According to Roberts, it was Lyman who allowed the letter to be published, though Roberts defended Lyman by telling the apostles that it was not expressly stipulated that the letter be kept confidential. The letter was critical of Reed Smoot and his running for re-election for the U.S. Senate and being an apostle at the same time. In 2 days of meetings on January 5th and 6th, 1909, with the 12 and First Council of 70, Roberts refused to apologize for his opinions in his letter about Smoot's bid for re-election, with his declaring that those were his views then and those are his views now. The two collective councils countered that Roberts ought not to have written such a letter and that he should have brought his grievances to the brethren. In writing about the conference address, George F. Richards claimed that President B.H. Roberts was handled by the Council of the Twelve and the 70 some months ago, meaning the previous January, for being out of harmony. He withstood us all and his case was presented to the First Presidency. And there it has since rested, and the argument made by him before the conference is, I judge, the argument he had prepared for his further hearing when it comes, if at all. Robert's talk is actually quite amazing. Apostle Orson F. Whitney admitted that it was eloquent, but criticized the speech as not imbued with the Spirit of the Lord. It caused sorrow to his friends and doubtless gave aid and comfort to the enemy. Roberts begins his talk with a comic story about speaking and listening. He mentions that he was called on at the last minute to speak after being under the impression he was not to be addressing this conference, presumably because of his conflict with the First Presidency and the 12. Roberts then discussed the talk President Howard W. Taft had given in Utah just before conference and its importance for Utah politics. Roberts continued, "Our people have not always been blameless in their attitudes as a community as to the things we have done, but our history, which is but another name for our conduct, is not always defensible at all points." Roberts continues along this train of thought, delivering what, to a modern ear, is a stunning achievement in balance and perspective. Joseph F. Smith was the concluding speaker of the October 1909 conference. It must have been clear to everyone in the audience that Smith's harsh comments were aimed at Roberts. George F. Richards recorded that Smith denounced Roberts and his talk in unmeasured terms without mentioning his name. While Whitney believed that Smith's closing remarks were a dignified and telling rebuke to the foolish remarks made by some of the brethren, God forbid should I ever deserve such a reproof. Here is part of Smith's reproof directed at Roberts. There never, perhaps, was a time in the church when there was not foolish ones amongst us. Some have been foolish through overzeal. Some have been still more foolish through lack of zeal. Altogether, some have been foolish in saying things they ought never to have said. I do not think it is my right or prerogative to point out the supposed defects of the prophet Joseph Smith or Brigham Young or any other leaders of the church. I felt that it was my duty to say this much at the conclusion of this conference. When the Lord wants to reveal something new to us, He knows the channel through which to reveal it. He knows that we can do it, and He will do it in His own way and time through the proper channels of the priesthood. Don't forget that. After conference, according to George F. Richards, he saw Roberts go to the president when the benediction had been offered, and just what was said, I do not know. Richards then walked up and shook the president's hand and told him, I thank the Lord for those concluding remarks. I felt they were appropriate and needed. About a week after conference had ended, on October 15th, Anthon Lund, second counselor in the first presidency, recorded that Roberts came in and told the president that if the speech was radically wrong, he would let it be left out of the conference pamphlet. President Smith said to him to submit it to me, and what I suggested would meet his mind. I told Brother Roberts to make what changes he desired, and we would go over it together. Roberts' edited address and Smith's address are found in the October 1909 conference report. The third example involves an address by Apostle James E. Talmage, speaking at April 6, 1915, with the title The Son of Man. 5 weeks after conference, on May 10, 1915, Talmage wrote in his journal that the conference report had been delayed owing to a consultation regarding his own brief address. It seems Charles W. Penrose, second counselor in the first presidency, was concerned that Talmage's talk would cause difficulty to the elders in the field, who he thinks would be confronted with the charge that we as a people worship a man. The parts removed were two paragraphs, a couple of sentences, and quotation marks. These omissions shed light on Penrose's concern. Talmage said that the title, The Son of Man, is applied to Christ to express his unique relationship to human family, and that it was one of the highest titles he could assume. Talmage had also stated that the Father of Jesus Christ, the Father of the Spirit, and the Father of his body was a man, and has progressed not by any favor, but by the right of conquest over sin and over unrighteousness. His present position of priesthood and power of Godship and godliness. In another paragraph, Talmage commented that if you saw the Eternal Father sitting upon the throne, you would see a glorified, perfect man. It was changed to read that if you saw the Eternal Father sitting upon his throne, you would see him like a man in form. I personally find the talk a wonderful piece of Mormon theology and fully in harmony with Joseph Smith's King Follett discourse. This talk shows why Talmage has such a profound influence on Mormon theology and why he wrote Articles of Faith and Jesus the Christ as church-authorized projects. Although Talmage doesn't mention it in his journal, I think that Penrose may have had a second concern with the talk. In Jesus the Christ, published the same year, Talmage stated he was the only male human being that Adam down who was not the son of a mortal man. An omitted sentence in the conference address reads, Jesus Christ was the only human being that has ever walked the earth since Adam, who was not the son of a mortal man. So that it switched there. Before, it excludes Adam, but in the conference address, he's including Adam as being the son of a divine being. Talmage included the complete, unedited version of his conference address in his journal, reprinted in 1997 in the book, The Essential James E. Talmage, published by Signature Books. Talmage wrote that he included the full report in his journal because President Joseph F. Smith desired that the full and original report be preserved. Talmage also explains in his journal why, despite his compliance with editing, he felt that his original represented correct Latter-day Saint theology. After presenting a logical and concise explanation of his theological position that the title, The Son of Man, is in, reference to Christ being the Son of the only supreme glorified man, Talmage then concludes that this conception of the title, the Son of Man, has been incorporated into my forthcoming book, Jesus the Christ, and that it was submitted to and approved by President Joseph F. Smith. This theology is found in Jesus the Christ, Chapter 2, under the subheading, The Son of Man. The October 1923 closing session is the fourth example. This session was held on October 7th in the afternoon, when J. Golden Kimball, one of the First Council of 70, gave a brief speech. According to the Ogden Standard Examiner, there has seldom been a conference where Mr. Kimball has spoken at which the sense of humor he has stirred was not manifest. His speech yesterday afternoon was no exception. His unique phrasing of the same sentiment that had been previously stated by several other speakers brought smiles that were transformed into laughter when he told of having last year received a Christmas present COD. Then he pointed the moral. "Of course I paid for it," he said. "That's the way God's blessings come, COD. You don't get anything unless you deserve and pay for it." The genuine sensation happened when Mr. Kimball, bearing testimony of the truth of Mormon faith, said, "I know that the Mormon Church is true, that Jesus Christ was a prophet of God, and when I know a thing, I know it. Why worry about what the other fellow says? As far as I'm concerned, they can go to hell. And that's where most of them belong." Mr. Kimball took his seat without the usual, "In the name of Jesus Christ, amen." President Grant at once arose and said, "Pardon me, but I do not desire laughter be provoked in our worship." The Salt Lake Tribune is pretty much the same account, but there's a bit of a twist at the end. Instead of Grant getting up after Kimball was finished in the telegram version, Grant seems to interrupt Kimball before he can finish with an amen. The reporter writes, "The last statement brought laughter from the large crowd, and President Grant, evidently provoked at the proceedings, arose and said, 'Pardon me, but I do not desire that laughter be provoked in our worship.'" The Deseret News reported on the talk, writing, "Elder Kimball said he could testify to the truth of all that has been said during the conference, and if God would be patient with him, he was willing to make all necessary sacrifices. I love this work," Elder Kimball said. "And I love God because he is a God of mercy and justice. He declared he had found God in the southern states while on a mission, but that anyone to gain this knowledge must eat the bread of persecution and drink the waters of affliction." Elder Kimball testified he knew God lived and that he expected pay for all his blessings and promises given. The fifth example occurred on April 9, 1932, when Stephen L. Richards gave a conference address titled "Bringing Humility to the Gospel." The Salt Lake Tribune described the address as a keynote address message of the second day of conference. In his talk, Richards expressed concern about those who behave with prejudice towards those whom they see as sinful. Richards was aware that many people had left the church because they used tobacco, coffee, tea, and used face cards, played pool, or billiards, all of which were looked down by fellow church members. Near the end of Richards' talk, he said quite poetically, "This is one of the most beautiful talks generally I've ever read. It's an absolutely beautiful talk. I have said these things because I fear dictatorial dogmatism, rigidity of procedure, and intolerance even more than I fear cigarettes, cards, and other devices the adversary may use to nullify faith and kill religion. Fanaticism and bigotry have been the deadly enemies of true religion in the long past. They have made it forbidding, shut it up in cold gray walls of monastery and nunnery, out of the sunlight and fragrance of the growing world. They have garbed it in black and then in white, when in truth it is neither white nor black, any more than life is white or black. For religion is life abundant, glowing life, with all its shades, colors, and hues. As the children of men reflect in the pattern of their lives the radiance of the Holy Spirit in varying degrees." Immediately after the session, the First Presidency and 12 met to discuss the talk. They were so concerned with Richard's talk that the final decision at the end of May was not to publish it. According to Talmage's journal account, the question was whether to allow the address to be published in full at the time. Brother Richards urged a tolerant and kindly attitude towards those of our people, particularly young people, who became addicted to some habits in violation of the revelation known as the Word of Wisdom. And a question has been raised as to whether the effect of this address will be that of leading to the thought that the church is lowering its standards. 2 days later, on April 11th, Church President Heber J. Grant recorded in his diary that mission presidents and stake presidents were disturbed about Brother Stephen L. Richards' talk. On two different days, April 22nd and May 2nd, Richards wrote a letter to two different friends expressing the hope that his discourse will be helpful to better understanding and that no one will get from it the impression that I desire to lower the high standards to which we have always held. On an April 26th, Apostle David O. McKay noted in his diary that Joseph Fielding Smith, Richards, McKay, and McKay were busy editing Richards' talk. On May 5th, at the First Presidency and 12 meeting, there was a long discussion about Richards' talk and whether it should be published in the conference report. After the meeting, Grant told McKay and Anthony Ivins that Richards had made a mistake when he delivered the address, but today he made a fool of himself. That evening, Grant confided in his diary that it would be a mistake to publish Richards' address. Shortly thereafter, Grant left Salt Lake City for D.C. when he visited with U.S. Senator and Apostle Reed Smoot. On May 8th, Smoot recorded in his diary that in the evening had a long talk with President Grant about conditions at home. He told me of the unfortunate remarks Stephen L. Richards made at the last conference. Stephen L. was ready to resign, but President Grant thought that would not happen. It is apparent that Richards offered his resignation from the 12 and refused to change his talk for publication during the May 5th meeting. After Grant returned home, Richards told him on May 26th that he felt he had made a mistake by preaching his address, and it was all right with him for the First Presidency to take whatever action they saw fit regarding it. Grant recorded that he was very happy to have Richards make this confession, because he had a great deal of worry during the trip east. On May 27th, Grant told one of the staff at the Improvement Era that the magazine could not publish Grant Richards' talk. On May 30th, Grant wrote to Smoot about Richards' confession, saying that he had made a mistake in giving the address and that it was all right for the First Presidency to publish the talk or not. Grant believed that it would be very difficult to print the address since it would need a statement accompanying the text, which would then bring more attention to the talk. Grant decided to let the matter drop, and if it doesn't appear in the conference pamphlet, it will soon be forgotten that the speech was made. The address was not published until Sunstone Magazine printed it in 1979, apparently satisfying Grant's hope that it was forgotten. But this is not the end of the story. The talk that Sunstone Magazine published was an edited version of the original talk delivered at conference. In the earliest draft of the talk, which has never been published, Richards wrote, "Some important changes in the ordinance, forms, and methods have been made in recent years. A comment from a general authority who supported changes in ordinances would not go unnoticed by fundamentalist Mormons, the audience, or other general authorities, because both the endowment ceremony and the temple garment had undergone major changes in the last 10 years prior to this address." In the edited version, "in the ordinances, forms, and methods" was removed. The Salt Lake Tribune reported Richards as saying, "I hold it entirely compatible with the genius of the church to change its forms of procedures, customs, and ordinances in accordance with our own knowledge and experience. I would not discard any old practice merely because it is old, but only after it has outworn its usefulness." If this report is accurate, then Richards was also advocating changes in the ordinances of the church. Also removed from the edited version was Richards' advice that the church should work with members who did not follow its advice on the Word of Wisdom, billiards, and face cards. "I would modify the campaign and the council and surround them with safeguards which I think have often been lacking." The word "surround" replaces the word "modified" in the edited version. Even with the disturbance this talk caused, in 1951, Richards became David O. McKay's first counselor in the First Presidency. Smith was asked to edit the talk before publication. When I printed it out, I made a mistake. The sixth example is another address. It's funny that I jumped so far ahead. The sixth example is another address given by J. Golden Kimball. When he addressed the General Conference on April 9, 1933, the majority of the information about this address comes from Heber J. Grant's diary. On April 16, 1933, Grant recorded that Edward P. Kimball, Golden's nephew and tabernacle organist, had told him he was very glad that Grant had rebuked Uncle Golden at the April conference, and that Edward had felt humiliated for his uncle's talk the way, for his uncle to talk the way he did. 3 weeks later, on May 5th, Grant went to Golden's office to discuss the talk. Golden was absent, but two of Golden's half-brothers, Joseph and Albert, were present and told Grant that they felt it would be an injustice for Grant to publish Golden's corrected speech, that it would put Grant in a poor light not to publish his speech in full as Golden had delivered it. On May 19, 1933, Grant finally met with Golden to discuss the talk. Here's the account from Grant's diary. J. Golden Kimball called shortly after 10 o'clock, and I had a long talk with him regarding his speech at conference. I told him that under no circumstance would I consent to having his speech remodeled the way he had changed it, because it would be a direct reflection on anything I had said, because there would be nothing there to criticize. I told him plainly that he must quit using the name of God, that I considered absolute profanity when he said, "God, how I hate prejudice." And when he referred to his conversation with Brother Lyman, in which he told Brother Lyman, in answer to his question as to whether he loved the brethren, that he loved some of them a damn sight better than others. It was absolutely ridiculous to talk that way. I told him I wanted him to understand that I wouldn't and could not sustain him as one of the general authorities of the church if he did not change. He said he would do his best to improve. He further said that if I did not want to publish his remarks, it would be all right with him. I said, "I am going to publish your talk in full, and mine too, unless you don't want me to." He said he would prefer not to have the talk published. I tore it up and threw it in the wastebasket. I was disappointed over my interview with him from the fact that he did not come out frankly and fully and say, "Brother Grant, I apologize. I did wrong and I am sorry. But we are all differently constituted, and I was glad to have a talk with him and to have him assure me he would endeavor to mend his ways." I read my talk to him word for word as it was delivered, in which I referred to my love for him, his testimony of the gospel, and there is practically no criticism whatever in it. I told him that if I had referred to his taking the name of God in vain and insulting his senior president, there might have been some complaint, but I made it as mild as I know how. Golden is given to being very careless in his utterances, and I do not hope, and I do hope and pray that he will change in the future. I always have liked him. He is fearless and has a strong testimony of the gospel, but he is as careless in his talk as mortal man can be. He pledged his absolute loyalty to me, but I would think more of his pledge if he would be more careful in his talk. The Salt Lake Tribune and Deseret News gave just a two-sentence summary of it. The following scenario is only speculation, but it seems probable that Kimball's remarks would have been extemporaneous. The record of the talk that Grant tears up would most likely be the only copy created by the conference recorder. This creates the possibility that this would have been the only record of the talk. The seventh example of a censored conference address occurred on April 6, 1947, when newly sustained church patriarch Eldred Smith began his first conference address saying, "Brethren and sisters, I think you are aware of the fact of the hereditary nature of the office to which I have been called. For that reason, I was prepared to give a speech for this occasion 15 years ago, but not today. Maybe it's because I don't like to get burned in the same fire twice." Smith continues forthrightly by saying he knew that rumors had floated around because many people said after that occasion, "I was not called because I was not worthy." Smith states that he met with President Grant that evening before Joseph F. Smith was called to church patriarch and asked if that was the reason he was not sustained in 1932, with Grant replying, "Oh, no, 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 on the contrary. In fact, you have made quite a reputation for yourself in church activities." Smith continues by detailing his activity, beliefs, and church leadership position in an obvious effort to lay out his credentials before the congregation. Whatever the success of this move as far as establishing his personal worthiness was concerned, it has inevitably raised the question of why then had he not been called to his hereditary position in 1932. Smith was asked to edit the talk before publication. He did so and turned in his revisions, but the version that was finally published in the April 1947 conference report was a third version entitled A Testimony of Truth. The eighth example occurred on Tuesday, April 6, 1965, when Apostle Ezra Taft Benson spoke at the afternoon session of the General Conference. Benson had recently returned from his European mission, which many people felt had been a way of removing him from U.S. politics and the John Birch Society. Benson began his talk discussing church objectives and that the Lord expects the method to be worked out by his people. Sometimes programs are developed to help meet the church's objectives, but Benson suggests the reward is not as great when members rely on detailed programs to accomplish their objectives. Benson then moves into what he and President McKay see as the great threat to the church, the communist conspiracy. Benson says that the war in heaven is raging on earth today. Satan argues that men, given their freedom, do not choose wisely. Therefore, a so-called brilliant, benevolent few must establish the welfare government and force us into a greater socialist society. We are assured of being led into the promised land as long as we let them put a gold ring in our nose. In the end, we lose our freedom and the promised land also. No matter what you call it, communism, socialism, or the welfare state, our freedom is sacrificed. Benson argued that countries have been pushed into communism by evil forces and that these evil forces are operating within our own country. Benson further claimed that the devil had, to a large extent, neutralized much of the priesthood. But if they should ever wake up, they could step forth and help preserve freedom. The Benson talk, along with the other conference addresses, were covered in the Salt Lake Tribune and Deseret News the following day. But Benson's talk also made the national spotlight on April 13, 1965, by being covered in the Washington Post article titled, Benson Ties Rights Issue to Reds in Mormon Rift. In a meeting of the First Presidency on April 23rd, Hugh B. Brown pointed out the negative publicity with the Washington Post article and the unfavorable reactions he was hearing about Benson's remarks. McKay's initial reaction was that he had not noticed anything objectionable in what Brother Benson had said. McKay then asked Brown to bring him a report of the talk, and Brown told him he would do it at once. Later in the meeting, N.L. Tanner told McKay that he had also received telephone calls and letters about Benson's talk. On May 3rd, in a meeting between McKay and Brown, McKay authorized the elimination from Brown's talk of the following two paragraphs. Before I left for Europe, I warned how the communists were using the civil rights movement to promote revolution and eventual takeover of this country. When are we going to wake up? What do you know about the dangerous civil rights agitation in Mississippi? Do you fear the destruction of all vestiges of state government? Now, brethren, the Lord never promised there would not be traitors in the church. We have the ignorant, the sleepy, and the deceived, who provide temptations and avenues of apostasy for the unwary and the unfaithful. But we have a prophet at our head, and he has spoken. Now, what are we going to do about it? Do homework, brethren. If we had done our homework and were faithful, we could step forward at this time and help save this country. A month after Benson's talk, Apostle Harold B. Lee spoke at a BYU devotional on May 4, 1965. According to D. Michael Quinn, part of Lee's talk was directed at Benson in his remarks at General Conference. Quote, "It all sums up to this. Beware of that clever advocate, even in high places in the government or in the church, who deals in cunning half-truths or who endeavors to win his purposes by twisting the facts and so seeks for decisions based upon half-falsehoods. Sometimes that happens. So often men of authority in the church seek to buttress their position by making it appear that they speak for the highest church authorities, rather than to wait until the higher authority speaks for himself." As the ninth example, on April 5th, 1981, Hartman Rector Jr. of the First Quorum of 70 spoke at the Sunday afternoon session of conference. The talk was titled, Will the Earth Be Wasted?, with the themes of family, family history, and genealogical work. Rector voiced his concern that the family concept is under very serious attack today all over the world. Rector compares our day with Noah's and suggests that as in the days of the flood, he will surely destroy the earth because of this attack on the family. Rector then gives examples of these attacks on the family. Richter discusses a TV documentary that says old people are dying for a lack of love and attention, and that children no longer visit their parents, and some governments pay people to visit the elderly. Richter believes that because of this government intervention, children no longer have to worry about their parents in their old age, so they completely neglect them. Richter then moves into what seems to be, for him, the major attacks on the family: sterilization, vasectomies, abortion, birth control, and homosexuality. Richter is concerned about China's one-child policy and says that its method of enforcing the policy is through birth control, abortion, and sterilization. According to Richter, if a parent has a second child, this child is taken by the government to be raised. He believes this policy will literally destroy these nations. Richter said that the Lord will lay waste to the earth when he returned if children and fathers do not turn their hearts to one another. Richter believes that the writing of personal and family histories will do more to turn the hearts of the children to the fathers and the fathers to the children than almost anything we can do. By doing our personal family history, Richter claims our children will get a great desire to raise a family of their own when they see what a great blessing they were to you. If children have a happy family experience, they will not want to be homosexuals, which I am sure is an acquired addiction just as drugs, alcohol, and pornography. The promoters of homosexuality say they were born that way, but I do not believe it is true. There are no female spirits trapped in male bodies, and vice versa. This talk was thoroughly covered in the Salt Lake Tribune and Deseret News on Monday, April 6th, and the Church News on Saturday, April 11th, with quotes that were later removed from the published talk. In May, the talk was published in the Ensign with the new title, Turning the Hearts. All references to abortion, birth control, sterilization, vasectomy, homosexuality, and the reason for old people dying were removed from the Ensign. The talk was changed from an apocalyptic sermon to an upbeat pep talk about genealogy. When asked about the changes, Richter responded, "Sometimes it is not expedient to make people angry by telling them it is in too plain terms what their problems are. The Master many times spoke in parables to protect those who were not able to bear his message. Also, the Church is hoping to gain entrance into the communist China, so didn't want to make waves. I presume a combination of things made the First Presidency decide to eliminate certain portions of my remarks, even though they had received and cleared the talk before it was given. It is okay. They know best. However, what was said is still true. Regards, H.R. A tenth example was first reported on November 16, 1984, when the Salt Lake Tribune broke the story about changes in First Quorum of 70 member Ronald E. Pullman's October 7, 1984 General Conference Address. The Gospel in the Church, with the article Elder's Address, rewritten from conference version by Rod G. Wagner. Wagner wrote, "The address was heavily edited and partially rewritten for the November Ensign and was re-videotaped with the new version being spliced into the conference tape for church distribution." Church spokesman Don LeFevre stated that the most obvious place to retape Pullman's talk was from the pulpit. But when Wagner asked if this could give a false impression about this being the original talk, LeFevre said it could. Some months later, in Sunstone, Peggy Fletcher Stack, who was editor at the time, wrote that Pullman returned to the tabernacle a few days after conference and retaped the speech with the changes. The tape was then spliced into the original conference tape, replacing the previous address. In addition, a cough track was provided to make it sound like an audience was present. Stack also points out that the cost of this video editing was between $10,000 to $15,000. Church spokesman Jerry Cahill is quoted as saying, "I don't think $10,000 is too much to pay to correct a possible misinterpretation. Besides, if the brethren require it, we comply." It seems that the main concern centered on what Mormon fundamentalists would think of the talk. The general authorities for years had been countering fundamentalist claims that there were in fact two churches. One church was a part of the world, and another church followed a higher or spiritual law. Stack wrote that apostles who regularly deal with Mormon apostate groups pointed out to Elder Pullman that his remarks might be misinterpreted. Pullman's brother Stuart is quoted in the Tribune saying that Ronald Pullman was concerned his remarks would be used by Mormon apostate groups. Some of the changes support these concerns voiced by the apostles. Free agency also seems to have been a concern. Of the three times it is used in the original talk, two times it was removed, and the third time it was modified. In the original talk, the final use of free agency says that we should not invent our own values and principles. But in the edited version, the church adds, the church aids us in our efforts to use our free agency creatively, not to invent in our own values, principles, and interpretations. After the revised talk had been published, the church public communications office said Pullman had been instructed that his talk might possibly be misinterpreted, and that any editorial changes were his own. Stuart Pullman in the Salt Lake Tribune article said he was told by the general authorities that changes were by the, I'm sorry, said he was told by the general authority, meaning Pullman, his brother, the changes were his idea and not from pressure of other church officials. Pullman did not speak in general conference again for over 4 years, the next time being April 1989. A side-by-side comparison of the original delivered talk and the edited version is found in October 1990 issue of Sunstone. The final example is the talk presented by Quorum of the Twelve President Boyd K. Packer at the October 10th conference. The talk's focus is on the family and what Packer sees as the modern world's threat to sanctify the sanctity of marriage and raising of children. Packer tells the audience, 15 years ago, with the world in turmoil, the First Presidency and Quorum of the Twelve issued the family, a proclamation to the world, the fifth proclamation in the history of the church. At this point in the original version, Packer suggests that the proclamation qualifies according to the definition as a revelation and would do well that members of the church to read and follow it. In the published version, this last sentence was changed to read, it is a guide that members of the church would do well to read and follow. Packer continues by discussing parenthood and the procreative power of humans, saying that the power to create life carries with it the greatest of joys and dangerous temptations. He then focuses on pornography as a plague against the family and suggests its influence is most frequently brought into the home through the husband and father. Packer then moves into the subject of same-sex attraction and marriage. Packer tells the audience that some suppose that they were preset and cannot overcome what they feel are inborn tendencies towards the impure and unnatural. Not so. Why would our Heavenly Father do that to anyone? The last sentence was removed in the published text, and the word tendencies was changed to temptations. Packer then says that the church has to stay on course in its opposition to same-sex marriage, no matter what opposition it faces, that moral standards cannot be changed by battle and cannot be changed by ballot. He then ties the staying on course as God's law, and without it, family, civilization, or liberties must needs perish. Packer then ends his talk by telling people that through repentance, they can overcome the habit or an addiction that is unworthy, and promises people that ahead of you is peace and happiness for you and your family. By Sunday afternoon, there was a discussion on the internet about Packer's talk and what it meant to the church and to homosexuals. The Salt Lake Tribune ran its first of many stories about Packer's address on Monday, October 4th. The article discusses people's concerns and how the address would affect the church and its relationship with gay people, believing that it would have a negative effect on members immediately and their attitude towards gay people. Stack also pointed out that the address seemed to contradict an October 1995 Ensign article by Apostle Dallin Oaks on homosexuality and on the church's 2007 pamphlet on same-sex attraction called God Loveth His Children. The press coverage and internet responses continued to grow through the week. Also on Monday, the Human Rights Campaign, an organization dedicated to gay rights, released a statement saying that President Packer needed to correct his statement, calling his talk inaccurate and dangerous. By Thursday night, a protest had been organized with 4,500 people gathering at Temple Square to show their disapproval of the address. Near the same time, the revised version of the address was posted on the church's website. With the changes in the address, an entirely new round of discussion occurred in the news media and on the internet. A week after the address, some members of the church started a Facebook page supporting Packer and his address. What can be learned from this study? Most importantly, I suggest that changes censoring or publicly correcting conference addresses are rare. I have only documented 11 out of some 7,000 talks since 1897. I am sure there are other talks that fit within this group, but for the most part, general authorities seem to conform to the prescribed format of talks and are in harmony with one another when speaking. This conclusion is proclaimed over the pulpit in conference addresses. There are obviously similarities with President Packer's address and other examples I have cited. The church spokesman in Elder Pullman's case said that the general authorities review their comments before publication of the incident. And with President Packer's address, the spokesman says, following every general conference, each speaker has the opportunity to make any edits necessary. Also in both cases, it was either stated or implied that the changes were self-imposed rather than directed from someone in a higher position. Having a member of the First Presidency publicly correct a member of the 12's address is also found in the Taylor and Kimball examples. What differences do we find in the final example of President Packer's talk, and what do the changes mean? I believe the differences are significant. One of the differences with Packer's address would be his suggesting that a guide is actually a revelation, which for most members of the church would imply that the family proclamation is in fact scripture. An entire paper can be written about when a proclamation or written statement from the First Presidency becomes revelation or scripture. From a historical standpoint, this subject has no clear answer. This is not my purpose, but it is important to point out that the general authorities in this instance seem to have been not willing or ready to make this move with the family proclamation. What I believe to be another striking difference is that no other president of the 12 has been edited in the official report of the address or had a member of the First Presidency go public with a rebuttal. This is not the first time Packer's addresses have been controversial. In 1981, Packer gave the talk, "The Mantle is Far, Far Greater Than the Intellect," to church educational personnel, with the subject being about the tension that exists between history and faith. This talk was scheduled to be published in the February 1982 ensign, but was withdrawn later and published in BYU Studies. This change in publication venues would move the talk from a more general audience to those who only subscribe to BYU Studies. On October 30, 1988, Packer presented a talk titled The Law and the Light at the annual Book of Mormon Symposium sponsored by the Religious Studies Center at Brigham Young University, in which he begins with his first sentence by saying, "What I shall present is a personal conviction from which I am willing to take full responsibility." The talk discusses evolution in negative terms and was not published until 1990. Even with this caveat in the text, a disclaimer was inserted at the beginning of the talk. One reviewer observed that Packer's article has no apparent thematic connection to the Book of Mormon books around which this collection is organized, or indeed to the Book of Mormon at all. Speculation has been that in order to get the talk published, the disclaimer had to be inserted at the beginning of the talk because of concern by other general authorities. I can find no other disclaimer on a talk or address given by a general authority at BYU. As for Packer discussing homosexuality or same-sex marriage in conference addresses and other venues, this has been a subject of at least 5 different talks besides the 2010 address. There are common themes and words found in each address, and in each talk, Packer says that his remarks are directed to young people, and he is addressing young adults. In the General Conference priesthood session, October 2, 1976, Packer gave his "To Young Men Only" address, where he counseled priesthood men and boys that if someone who is gay makes advances towards you, you must protect yourself and even resort to violence in this protection. He also says that homosexual practices, however tempting, are perversion and there is no mismatching of bodies and spirits. At a 12-state BYU fireside on March 5, 1978, Packer began his talk to the one by saying that he was speaking to those who may be subject to homosexual temptation and said it is a temporary condition. In his talk, Covenants, given October 7, 1990, at the Sunday morning general conference session, Packer told his audience that there is a campaign to make spiritually dangerous lifestyles legal, and that homosexuality is an addition or tendency. One of the main differences in his 1990 address is that Packer says that there are many whys for which we just don't have simple answers. In his Sunday afternoon address, Ye Are the Temples of God, for October 8, 2000 conference, he quotes from the Proclamation of Family about gender, advises the audience that marriage is only between a man and a woman, and in referring to homosexuality says, "The adversary can take control of control of your thoughts and lead you carefully toward a habit and to an addiction, convincing you that immoral, unnatural behavior is a fixed part of your nature." Packer also says that legalizing same-sex marriage is forbidden in the laws of God and can never be made right. In his Saturday afternoon, October 4th, 2003 address, the standard of truth has been erected, as well as the 1978 and 1990 talks. He called homosexuality a tendency that is unnatural and a perversion. In his 2003 address, he also says that some work through political, social, and legal channels to redefine morality and marriage into something unrestrained, unnatural, and forbidden. But they never can change the design which he has governed human life and happiness from the beginning. These words and ideas in these talks are similar to the 2010 address. So while he never, except for the talk To the One, uses specific terms such as homosexual or same-sex attraction, it is clear that his personal euphemisms like unnatural and perversion refer specifically to homosexuality. With these examples, the question arises as to why this talk was edited. With this comparison of the talks, Packer said nothing really different in his 2010 talk about homosexuality or same-sex marriage than he had said in 76, 78, 90, 2000, 2003 addresses. As I pointed out earlier, the groundswell created on the internet has to be considered a major factor as to why editing changes were made to the talk, cleansing the inner vessel. It is also reasonable to suggest that this groundswell was in response to strong feelings among members of the church created by official church support for California's Proposition 8, which amended California's constitution to include a definition of marriage as being between a man and a woman. Then, 2 weeks before Packer's address, First Quorum of the 70 and church historian Marlon Jensen met in a private meeting with members of the Oakland, California stake in a response to the division created because of this official support for Proposition 8. Many people interpreted this meeting as a time of healing and a loving hand extended to all people. The timing and subject of President Packer's talk seemed to be a response to this meeting. It seems that because of these additions, we saw history made in October 2010. Thank you.
Well, those of you who were in the previous session where Mike Stevens talked about how to handle conflict, I hope you heard the resonances between his presentation and Joe's paper, which is, as far as I know, the first attempt to look at the topic of correcting or canceling conference talks at the church's highest public forum, General Conference. It's a beautiful job of research and very thoughtfully balanced, and I'm skipping some pre-1897 examples of conference talks that were censored on the spot, sometimes by Joseph Smith or Brigham Young. Joe's study covers a period when many of the rough edges of spontaneity have been smoothed away, and where the principles of unity and obedience dictate both the attitudes seen as appropriate for speakers and the attitudes seen as appropriate for the audience. The assumption also developed during that time that the conference reports would become not a journalist's coverage of a newsworthy event, but a record of proceedings, a task that the Ensign seamlessly took over from its predecessor, the Improvement Era, and which is in turn being taken over by the Internet. The span of dates from October 1897 to October 2010 is 114 years. And across that length of time, Joe has identified 11 censored talks, all of them involving addresses delivered before live audiences, in other words, living witnesses, but which afterward appeared in modified print form or not at all. The stories of the 11 talks themselves are enthralling, and I sincerely hope that many of the details now stuffed in Joe's footnotes will be fully available in the published version, which I understand will be in the fall issue of Sunstone. But let me, in my few minutes of response, tease out three elements that I think provide important context, not only for these talks, but for all of the conference talks that we will continue to hear from the pulpit and read, both on the church's website and in the conference issues of the Ensign. The first is the role of the hierarchy in managing the context of problematic talks. The second is the goal of unity, or preventing schism. And the third is a very obvious point, Some topics simply are controversial, and preaching about them over the pulpit will result in reactions that require damage control. First, although audience reaction may manifest the problem, the answer is hierarchical. For instance, when John W. Taylor related gossip about the Tabernacle Choir, a member of the First Presidency responded on the spot, labeling the information as inaccurate and the venue as inappropriate. John W. himself was required to make amends with the choir. Even in such a clear-cut case, however, it was already clear that individuals who react with irritation, alarm, or hurt feelings to statements over the pulpit are labeled as being offended, a negative reaction for which the immature member is supposed to repent. The speaker is not labeled as offending. Thus, the official hierarchical operating procedure is to minimize audience reaction, deflect the response through an authoritative figure that reframes the issue, and, if necessary, requires a symbolic withdrawal of the offense-giving material, either by direct apology or, more frequently, as these examples show, by editing the published version. The case of President Packer presents a distinctive and new response to the usual formula. I know from comments on listservs and personal reactions that some of those offended called President Packer's office directly or the Public Communications Department. In each case, they were pleasantly listened to and shunted to another line where the male respondent, in the examples I've heard of, listened patiently and even sympathetically, stopped short of agreeing with the speaker, but went so far, the speaker who was calling in to complain, but going so far as to say, I know. In case any of us missed the trend that has been developing over the last decade, public affairs and its spokespersons occupy an ambiguous but definite point in the chain of command. Since President Packer heads the Quorum of the Twelve, only the First Presidency could enforce a hierarchical conclusion. But they were completely invisible in this contretemps, except, as Joe has pointed out, the immediate counter-speech by President Uchtdorf preaching a message of love for all. While this exchange of official statements seems to move the church back to its usual position on homosexuality, love the sinner, hate the sin, perhaps even more significant is the step back inflicted on the family, a proclamation to the world. Elder Packer has long insisted on treating this anonymously by committee document as revelation, as do most members of the church. But its significance on this issue is that it provides the sole doctrinal authority that gender is fixed, premortal, mortal, and postmortal, with the corollary that sexual desire has an exact correspondence to gender. Males desire females, females desire males. Variations are considered non-existent, or if individual cases are so crass as to force themselves into the public view, they can be brushed aside as inconsequential. So, my first point, drawing on two of Joe's examples, is that protest among members at a sufficient degree to draw official attention to itself receives a hierarchical response at a level about that of the speaker. In Elder Packer's case, that hierarchical response was not vertical from the First Presidency, but lateral from the Church Public Affairs Department. This is an important modification in what we usually consider to be the hierarchy. Second, the response to a protest-arousing talk requires the capitulation and cooperation of the speaker. Joe has stressed the importance of unity. He and I have shared a chuckle over the times when President Hinckley or someone else has announced, "The brethren have never been more united." Given the context of these announcements, it's pretty obvious that at least one of the purposes of such statements is to wallpaper over cracks developing in the hierarchy. But the serious purpose of such statements is to reassure church members and, even more important, to require the other general authorities to acquiesce in public measures that present a facade of functional unity. As a result, the church has not experienced serious schism, by my estimation, since the Morrisites of 1862. The Godbeites failed to find a solid constituency, and the Third Convention in Mexico did not rise to the level of church-wide consciousness. Swift excommunications and other distancing mechanisms have drawn firm boundaries between Mormons and the FLDS and other nascent and largely unsuccessful departures from the mainstream. Look again at the examples of J. Golden Kimball, Stephen L. Richards, and B.H. Roberts. tough men, men of integrity. Their message is thoughtful, and in Jay Golden's case, even passionate. But part of the hierarchical response in every case was that they had to acquiesce in the revision of their conference talks. Where is the line because their where is the line between their acquiescence because somebody might misunderstand it, the FLDS in the Richards case, and their admitting that it was a mistake? This institutional response required that the erring speaker had, in essence, to denounce his own statement. I found the meeting between Heber J. Grand and Jay Golden Kimball particularly poignant for that reason. Kimball relinquished the content of his talk into bureaucratic hands and let Heber J. Grant tear it up and throw it in the wastebasket, a symbolic action, if there ever was one. But even this gesture of submission was not enough. Grant remained disturbed because Golden would not capitulate on the underlying issue. He would not say, "I was wrong, I apologize." The third point is the blacklist of conference talk topics. From Joe's 11 examples, we can identify church-state relationships, political involvement, doctrinal understandings like the identity of Jesus and the role of free agency, but above all, social movements, birth control, care of the elderly, juvenile delinquency, and homosexuality. Most of these social movements have been drawn under the larger umbrella of the positively phrased pro-family movement, with the result that the number of topics coded as anti-family has increased over time. The undeniable backlash among Mormons who refuse to give up their gay children or participate in thinly disguised church lobbying activities, Proposition 8 may have been the last straw for many, means that the emphasis on families is contested ground. I think one measure of that contest is that the official public communications response to President Packer's unilateral attempt to declare the proclamation on the family as revelatory was to clarify it as a guide, a change with which President Packer publicly acquiesced, or at least did not publicly protest. It will be interesting to see whether the felt need by general authorities for unity will let us see other talks that deal soberly and thoughtfully with such undeniable family issues as illegal immigration into the United States, or the demographic shift among missionaries from unmarried youngsters to older couples, or even older men unaccompanied by wives. A renewed emphasis in the past 3 or 4 years has been stronger pronatalism, doubtless in response to the falling birth rate among white Mormons in North America. Even more interesting, an increasing number of second coming talks and attempts to explain natural disasters as signs of the last day are a developing trend. As an absorbed and interested conference watcher, I enjoy the numerous feel-good, do-good conference talks, but I'm most attuned to variations in that pattern that may suggest straws in an as-yet-unseen wind. And I thank Joe again for the indefatigable research and even-handed analysis that have brought us to this stimulating presentation. Thank you.
About 17 or 18 minutes. Now, I don't know, the speakers are way over here, and I think the only mic we have is here.
I'll stand over there.
Kevin, you can idea if you, you can bring your chair if you wanted to. Stand. And so, just address your question to one or the other or both, and we'll respond. Yes, Alan.
Joe, do you know of any instances where correction has occurred at a lower level, say at a state level, for example, where the general authorities have stepped in and corrected something that a state president may have said at a conference?
I've never bothered to keep track of that, but I have read in different accounts where a general authority will get up and say completely different. I think even Wilford Woodruff's diary talks about that, you know. And then I was reading Joseph Musser's diary, and where he's at, you know, I mean, there's times like where, and this isn't really talk, but he's actually sitting up on the stand, and Joseph Fielding Smith comes in and chews the stake president out. Because he was, oh, and the reason is because he was like in the high council before he was excommunicated. And so, but the stake president's still having him come sit up on the stand. And so the stake president chews, or the Josephine Smith chews him out and says, never allow that again. And there's all kinds of stuff like that that happens. But that would be, you'd have to be Mike Quinn when he went through all those diaries.
When you ask a question, be sure to speak up loud, and ideally come on down to the front.
Well, this is actually
heard better on the tape.
Joe, repeat the question.
Oh, yeah, I'll just repeat it. That's probably a better way.
Well, this is quite relevant.
Yes, Russ.
I was on a high council in 1971 when the regional representatives were first called. Robert D. Hales was the regional representative from the Hattiesburg, Mississippi State. Because of the way the state president treated Robert D. Hales, Mary G. Romney and Robert D. Hales called a special conference and immediately released him publicly over less than a week. So I have seen the first presidency intervene in the state in a very abrupt and direct way to correct what the state president was saying about the new representative. If that's what any of us.
Okay. I saw Ron's hand. You want to come down to Mike?
Let me just add from here, if I could. Levina, I'm wondering if there's a lateral handoff to public communications. What are they kind of a rogue operation? Are they getting behind the scenes from Luchtor for Henry Eyring permission or the direction? Or what do you think is going on there?
Ron's question was whether there might be a lateral handoff to public communications to handle controversial situations so that the first presidency doesn't have to be an attacker in public, in essence. I don't know if you had any inside information on that. I don't either. I think that the existence of public communications makes it possible for questions like this to be handled in a way that does not present an image of conflict. You don't have President Monson saying, I really disagree with what President Packer just said in this conference, but let me tell you about my first date with Francis. the fact that it can be handled by public communications means that the facade of unity continues. What I think is unusual, though, and what we don't know quite how to factor in, is that people feel free to call up the church office building, and everybody has access to that telephone number now, and they also have access to the church's website and can send in emails that express divergent opinions, and apparently do so without the automatic response that this is going to get back to my state president, and he's going to get my temple recommend. So there's a two-way change going on there. More responsiveness from the Mormon public and more responsiveness to the Mormon public from this entity in the church that's not part of the hierarchy, but is acting like part of the hierarchy. It sounds like Camilla's got something wrong.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, do you think there's someone either in the 12 apostles or in the first presidency who is talking to public affairs and saying, do something about this?
What's your opinion, Joe? I have the feeling that the President Luttrell and President Eyring are fairly with it, President Monson isn't. But I also think there's a real generational split in the Quorum of the 12. You look at people like Quentin Cook and Neil Anderson versus Perry and who else is up there?
Well,
yeah.
And then Nelson's up there too.
And Mallory is sort of a transitional figure because he's been responsible for public communications for so long. I don't know how you would track that except to say who makes ceremonial appearances, and then who does real live stuff like Elder Cook's Porteous column, things like that.
Yeah,
So your melodious voice will be on the tape much clearer. But I'll make one comment about the community of Christ. The Ardenal authorities are on the platform, they vote on issues in the conference. But at least I haven't really watched closely lately. For a long time, it was to just sort of assume they avoided voting no. They tried to avoid being split in the platform. I have seen times in recent years that they haven't been split in the platform, but it's usually like 1 or 2 seconds. I don't think anybody ever got harassed for it. Other questions, comments? You might want to get a quicker start to get ready for backup, so you don't have to go until 6 if you are tired and ready to take a break. Anybody? I don't mean to try to discourage further comments. But yes. Come on down. I moved to
within the last couple of years, I don't know exactly which conference it was, Elder Corbridge, a newly called General Authority, gave a talk, and it was focused on the importance of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And he's twice in his talk says, any other path is madness, was the word he used. And then, and any other attempt at trying to be happy in life is madness. The only way to be happy is through the gospel of Jesus Christ. And then in the published talk, it changed the word madness to foolishness. And I thought that was really odd, because it's okay to call people fools, but it's not okay to call them mad. And it didn't seem to have any purpose, but it was a definite change. And I wonder if you noticed that.
I hadn't. Now, do you know when?
It was within the last couple of years. I believe it's his only general conference address. Elder Corbridge. And he's been a practicing attorney in Salt Lake, and he just called in the 70s in the last couple of years, and it was his first, I believe, only conference address. It was foolishness or madness changed to foolishness.
Well, and if we're looking for straws in the wind, there may be a translation issue, because mad means angry, and we don't want to encourage the saints to think that they can be angry even if they're sinning when they're doing it. But how did any of you people who watch conference, how do you interpret the fact that 14 fundamentals of following the prophet got quoted not once but twice during conference? Where did that come from and why?
Grant Moore has the answer.
When we were out in CES,
come on down.
We want you on record on this, Grant. This might get them to lift your disciplinary.
Yeah. I think I'd get much more trouble. When I was in CES. After that talk was given, the 14 fundamentals, we were told not to use that in a classroom. It came down through our CES leaders, down through Hal Eyring, down the first presidency and so forth, or whoever was in. And then we began to hear a backstory, and I never heard anyone else tell this, and I don't know where it came from, but it came down the same chain of CES authority, and the backstory was that President Kimball was not happy with President Elder Benson's presentation about 14 fundamentals. Wasn't he President Cornwell at the time?
Yeah.
I believe so. And President Kimball had him get up in the Cornwell 12 and apologize for giving that talk, and have him repudiate several of those 14 fundamentals. And according to this story, down through my CEO's leadership, when it was over, President Kennedy says, that is not adequate, and had him get up again in the Quorum of the 12 and to say it more emphatically, which he did. And I've never heard that story, so when I heard that presented twice in the general conference, I was shocked. both because of the backstory that I heard, and secondly, we were not to use that in the seminary institute classroom.
Okay, others?
I guess my principal, the essence of my question is, to what extent are some of these differences mitigated amongst the brethren? I'm thinking of a hypothetical situation where an apostle might be vigorously opposed to some particular action that's being taken. Is that apostle then sort of accorded the privilege of just not being required to speak about that particular topic about which he has such strong feelings? Or does he have to really knuckle under and do what the rest of the quorum wants him to do?
I'm not sure what part of the transition or the conflict.
Well, I'll just pose the hypothetical situation. A good number of the brethren, or maybe the president of the church, wants a particular policy followed. But there is a strong objection by, say, one of the apostles. And that apostle feels so strongly that it becomes a real point of conflict. Is that apostle then relieved of the responsibility for saying anything publicly about the issue? Or is he required to knuckle under?
I think I understand what you're asking. The best example I can think of is the whole Benson stuff, which Mike Quinn has dealt with extensively. The whole Benson, you know, the entire Benson episode that Mike Quinn has dealt with. As I pointed out in my paper, there was a real sense, and I mean, it was a real sense. So Mike actually documents that people saw him being sent to Europe as a way to remove him. Now, he did come back for conferences and speak at conference, but his most radical ideas were set at BYU, or at that conference in Logan that he spoke at, where he quotes the John Birch Society Blue Book. And so by sending him to Europe, it stopped him from saying his most radical things. In my paper, I point out, though, to show how unified these guys are, or in the footnotes, actually, it's in the footnotes I document, it's not in a conference address, Hubie Brown, when he's called to be the first counselor in the first presidency, Benson gets up right afterwards and talks about that there are Judases in the highest levels of the church. Now, that was not a censored, I mean, that was not censored, that was left in. But everybody, at least the people in the know, knew exactly what Benson was saying, was that Hubie Brown was David Armitage's Judas. And 4 or 5, it's in my footnotes again, 4 or 5 years later, Benson gives the exact same address with the exact same words down at BYU. So, and he was never, ever censored, and as far as I know, you know, Gary, do you even remember? I don't think there's even anything even said in the case diaries about, you know, that they had a discussion over the Judas thing. I think that people came up to Brown and said, you know, we know Wilkinson's diary actually talks about that, you know, as Elder Benson got up and called Hubie Brown a Judas.
Okay, I think it's one last question because we're going to get quartered.
How about the case of B.H. Roberts and Joseph Fielding Smith on evolution?
Okay,
the one who lived the longest one, basically.
B.H. Roberts and
Joseph Fielding Smith on evolution.
Here's the story right here.
Yeah, but there was no controversy over conference addresses. That was all within the Quorum of the Twelve. Those discussions were all within the Quorum of the Twelve. And And actually, Talmadge was involved in that in some ways more than even Roberts. Sterling Talmadge writes all kinds of letters about it and discusses it with his father. There's even a story, and it's documented. I mean, Sterling documents it, and even Talmadge's, I think it's in Talmadge's diary. No, I'm sorry, it's not. But Sterling Talmadge and another scientist,
Iron.
Document, is it Iron? I don't know. Anyway, that Talmadge finds a fossil in a rock at Anamondiana and takes it in the Cormorant 12 beam and says, "So, Smith, how do you explain this?" Well,
okay, we're going to make this the last one for sure because we really are right at the end.
So if the addresses are edited before to prevent this having to edit them after, what happened with the Packard speech? Do you know, was it...
He did not go rogue. The address that he gave was the address that was given to the press. I verified that. And so he did not get up there and go rogue. And that's why I say, again, that's all in my footnotes, but that's why I say that it was this groundswell that changed. And then Levina's comments are brilliant because I can't document any of that stuff, but I believe she's correct that there is that lateral.
And I think the general authorities always look with eager anticipation to read Levina's conference critique. Ha ha ha!